From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The war on drugs. With a general heading up U.S. efforts, critics say militarization of the drug war further hurts the African-American community.
We really need to look at the long-range implications of what I call the criminalization of a race. We need to look at exactly what all of this increased incarceration will end up resulting in. More blacks having stigmatizing felony records, ensuring negative consequences for future employment. It will be virtual disenfranchisement for large segments of the African-American community, where conviction of a felony results in the loss of the right to vote.
What does Whitewater have to do with a leading timber conglomerate and President Clinton's environmental record? Investigative journalist Ken Silverstein tells us what he found out. And Clinton for President, political satirist Kate Clinton checks in from the campaign trail. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Steve Forbes is quitting the presidential race. A campaign source says Forbes will be endorsing Dole for the nomination. Not long ago, Forbes was denouncing the Senate Majority Leader as a tax raiser and an untrustworthy Washington insider. Forbes has spent more than $25 million of his own fortune in pursuit of the nomination. He won in Delaware and Arizona, but fell far behind soon after. What would you do if you had $25 million to spend? Why don't you send us an email or a letter and tell us what you do? We'll read them on the air. You can send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. At the end of the show, we'll give you our address as well. In other news, the Progressive Caucus is releasing its alternative budget today in Congress. Among its proposals, cutting the military budget. None of the major presidential candidates are calling for any kind of military budget cuts, but there are U.S. citizens who are taking a stand. Two peace activists were sentenced to 10 months in prison yesterday for entering a California defense plant and damaging two Trident missiles with hammers. U.S. District Judge James Ware sentenced Jesuit priest Stephen Kelly and Susan Crane to 10 months each in federal prison for damaging government property and conspiracy. Each has already spent 7 months in prison awaiting trial and sentencing. Kelly and Crane admitted damaging the missiles in a protest against government spending on weapons of mass destruction. They carried out the protest August 7th last year to mark the 50th anniversary of the dropping of the U.S. atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of the Second World War. But they nevertheless pleaded not guilty and urged jurors at their trial to refuse to convict them. Some of the other headlines today: President Clinton's business partner in the ill-fated Whitewater venture came under close scrutiny yesterday in a trial that could damage Clinton's reelection bid. Government prosecutor Ray John called his first witness to back up claims that James McDougal, the real estate developer, was guilty of conspiracy and fraud in financing his ambitious projects in Arkansas in the mid-1980s. McDougal and his former wife Susan, also on trial, were partners of Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton in the failed Whitewater venture. What is Whitewater, anyway? Karen Friedman of the oh-so-politically-correct Players calls it Whatwater, and I know when most people hear about it, their eyes begin to glaze over. But there's one investigative journalist who has been talking about and investigating a part of Whitewater that few people have heard about and I doubt will make your eyes glaze over. He is Ken Silverstein, co-editor of Counterpunch, described by The Village Voice as the nation's leading political newsletter, which outshines all its competitors. He's also author of a forthcoming book with Alexander Coburn called Washington Babylon. Ken Silverstein, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Well, why don't you tell us your take on Whitewater and why you think it's significant?
Well, Whitewater is, as you indicated, an extremely confusing topic, and a lot of people do just sort of see the headline in the newspaper and go right by it. But at its origins, it's a very simple case of pretty gross influence peddling. Back in 1978, Bill Clinton was Attorney General of Arkansas, and he was preparing to run for the governorship. And in that year, he and Hillary, his wife, and Jim and Susan McDougal, the infamous owners of the Madison SNL, bought 230 acres of riverfront property in the Ozarks. And the title to the land was put in the Clintons' name, but they didn't put any money down. The McDougals actually had fronted the money for the down payment on the loan. Now, what's curious about this is that the land's previous owner of record was a partnership called 101 River Development. But this was strictly a cutout arrangement. 101 had been set up a few days prior to the sale of the land to the Clintons. And a few weeks after the sale, 101 went out of business. It was a three-week-long partnership.
Hmm.
The actual seller of the land was International Paper, one of the biggest timber companies in America. It's a $16 billion a year firm, and they own 7 million acres of land in the U.S. and 800,000 acres in Arkansas. The timber industry is extremely powerful in Arkansas. We hear all the time about the poultry industry, Tyson, Don Tyson, etc., and of course the Walmart empire. However, timber is one of the more powerful players in Arkansas. International Paper, Weyerhaeuser, Georgia Pacific, these three companies own 2.5 million acres of land in Arkansas, and they run 30 mills. So, getting back to the sale, International Paper sets up this dummy corporation. They sell the land to the Clintons. He's a powerful political figure preparing to run for the governorship.
At the time, what? He's Attorney General of Arkansas?
He's Attorney General, but he's already running for governor, his first campaign. Now, International Paper, for some reason, decided to sell the land to the Clintons extremely cheap. At the time, back in the late 70s, non-riverfront property in the same area of the Ozarks was selling for about $1,000 an acre. Well, for some reason, International Paper decided to sell the land to the Clintons and the McDougals for $500 an acre, and that was riverfront property. Mm. So we're talking about a discount of probably somewhere on the order of 75%. So this is the actual origin of Whitewater. This is the land which came to, which was where the Whitewater Estates were going to be built. So this is the origin of the whole Whitewater scandal is simply this land transaction.
I haven't read about this anywhere, this connection between International Paper and, at that time, Attorney General running for governor, Bill Clinton. Now, why is International Paper at this time, at that time, interested in Bill Clinton?
Well, this is a good question. Why didn't International Paper call Ken Silverstein and say, Ken, would you like to buy this riverfront land for $500 an acre? Well, this is what we see in American politics so often, is that big corporations, through their campaign donations and through favors like this, are able to win access and influence with powerful figures. Bill Clinton was Attorney General at the time. He had very important responsibilities in terms of enforcing environmental law. He was running for governor. He was the favorite to win the race for governor. I'd say that it's pretty clear that International Paper was seeking to win influence and favor with someone they thought could do them favors sometime down the road. And in fact, International Paper's thinking on this matter turned out to be very true, because Bill Clinton did, in fact, go on to win the 1980 election for the governor of Arkansas.
In fact, when he was campaigning, didn't he attack the records of the previous governors and really run on an environmental platform and make environmental promises and pledges?
Oh, yeah. He was going to really take on the big industries of the state, including the timber industries. The timber lords of Arkansas had been clear-cutting huge patches of forest during the previous years, and Clinton had said he was going to come in and he was going to crack down on the timber industry, and there were all sorts of promises. It wasn't just the timber industry. It was the poultry industry and everybody else who had been polluting the state.
We're talking to Ken Silverstein, who is an investigative journalist and puts out Counterpunch, Tells the Facts, and Names the Names. It's a newsletter that comes out twice monthly, and it's a newsletter not to be missed. So why is it that the corporate papers are missing this story? I mean, there certainly are enough headlines on Whitewater.
Well, I think there are a lot of stories on Whitewater. I am a frequent critic of the corporate press. In this case, I'm not sure it's the usual reasons, which are often laziness or simply. Often we do stories in the newsletter that to us look extremely ugly, and it looked like there are terrible conflicts of interest. To the mainstream press, especially the Beltway press, it looks like business as usual. I mean, this is the way the city runs, and so they don't see anything wrong about it, so they don't even bother to look into it. That's possibly partly the case here, too. This is not illegal behavior. The international paper, of course, can sell the land to the Clintons for $10. I mean, that would look even uglier, I suppose, but they're free to do it. It does, however, if you're a journalist, I would think you would want to look into what companies are giving money to candidates and what companies are, in this case, selling them land dirt cheap.
Tell us about the panel after Bill Clinton became governor that was set up, that he had promised that he would set up a deal with environmental issues.
Well, this is the key thing, of course, is that it's not just that international paper sold the land cheap. It's that they got some very nice favors from Clinton later. On the campaign trail, Clinton had said he was going to set up a panel on clear cutting and that they were going to take some very tough action. And environmentalists were all excited about the new governor. They were anxiously awaiting his actions. He comes in, and as we saw when Clinton won the presidency, the fiery campaign promises soon gave way to very different policies once he was in office. So he comes in, and he does, in fact, set up a panel on clear-cutting. And he does, in fact, put a certain number of conservationists on it. However, the timber companies got extremely perturbed by this. They were very upset. They lodged their protest with the governor's office, and Clinton, frightened, cowardly as always, quickly boots the conservationists. He throws them off the panel, and he stocks the panel with industry hacks. Not surprisingly, this panel then comes out with recommendations that rules and regulations that are scarcely beneficial to anybody, what we really want are suggestions and voluntary compliance from the companies. That would be a far more effective means of dealing with the situation. So this is how Clinton fulfilled his campaign promises, the win-win solution that he's now become famous for. Now, he did lose office in 82, and he went into a two-year period of exile, but he had learned his lesson by then. He had decided when he came back into office, or actually on the campaign trail in 84, that that he was not going to take on the powerful interest again. And he came back in. He got a lot of money for the campaign from International Paper, Tyson's, all the other big corporations. And at that point, there was nothing that he was going to do to challenge the big corporations of the state. Now, he comes in, and in 85, he signs into law a new tax break, a corporate tax break that, of course, all the big corporations of the state took big advantage of. And to offset this loss, he implements a new sales tax on the citizenry. And, of course, the sales tax is the most regressive sort of tax there is.
Now, one thing that you just overlooked in this little story were those 2 years where he was voted out of office. And we see this, of course, with a lot of Congress members in Washington. When they are voted out of office, you think they're serving the public interest. Maybe they'd go head up some nonprofit, but they end up being a lobbyist or representing some of the large corporations that they've been legislating around in Congress. What did Bill Clinton do during those 2 years that he lost the governorship?
Yes. When Bill Clinton lost the governorship, he was a period of deep reflection, apparently. He went to work at a Little Rock law firm called Wright, Lindsay & Jennings. This was the period when Hillary was, of course, at the Rose Law Firm. And he represented, during this period, the timber giants of Arkansas before state regulatory bodies such as the Pollution Control Board. This is the period that Bill Clinton decided he was a new Democrat, and we know what that means.
Ken Silverstein, again, he's our guest, and he's the investigative journalist who puts out Counterpunch, telling the facts and naming the names. Any last comment on this story before we move on to a couple of others? I think it's interesting to note the significance of International Paper, because we don't hear a lot about it here in Washington or New York. It's more out in rural areas. But, for example, how it does compare to the pollution that came from Tyson's chicken farms on the Arkansas River.
Yeah, terrible. It was one of the state's worst polluters. They have a big plant at Pine Bluff, and this plant spewed out about 2 million tons of toxic chemicals a year into the air and water. So this was one of the major polluters in the state of Arkansas that Clinton went very easy on.
Let's talk about another piece that you did entitled Gingrich and Breaux, Rent Them by the Hour.
Okay. And first, before we get to that, let me just say quickly that I don't want to say that I did them, because this is a publication I do with Alexander Coburn. So it's the two of us doing these stories. So I don't want him to think that I'm stealing all the credit. In any case, we did a story about Newt Gingrich and John Breaux.
John Breaux, of course.
John Breaux, the senator from the state of Louisiana, a Democratic senator, as being classic examples of the sort of politicians who take favors from corporations on a regular basis. Now, Newt, we learned, has, back in January, Newt was flying around the country and he was attending fundraisers for Republican congressional candidates. It turns out that he was flying to these campaign fundraisers on a U.S. tobacco corporate jet. He flew as far north as Seattle, as far south as Dallas, I believe. He was all over the country, and he was in a corporate jet, and he was accompanied on the jet by a lobbyist, a Beltway lobbyist from the Advocacy Group, which is a big firm here. And so Newt, to raise money for the Republicans, was saving a little money himself by flying around on a corporate jet. And not just any corporate jet, but U.S. Tobacco, which manufactures smokeless tobacco. You don't hear as much about smokeless tobacco as about cigarettes, but in fact, it's far, far deadlier. The Department of Health and Human Services issued a report a few years ago where they said there was an impending oral epidemic, epidemic of oral cancer due to the growing popularity of smokeless tobacco, especially that great product, cherry-flavored Skoal, which is extremely popular with kids. And so this is a corporation, I think the term merchant of death springs to mind here. So Newt was, this is not the first time Newt's been flying around on their plane. Last year, probably many of your listeners have heard of the Bohemian Grove. That's the elite group, which includes people like William Buckley, Gerald Ford, Henry Kissinger, and then they go off into the woods in California and frolic around, sometimes nude, and return to their pre-corporate roots, I guess. Newt flew to the Bohemian Grove's midsummer encampment last year on a UST plane, and also in
UST, of course, U.S.
U.S. Tobacco, which is how the company is referred to. And in mid-95, last year as well, there was a big fundraiser honoring Newt in New York, and UST lent its plane to 80 Republican members of Congress and flew all of them up there. Must be a pretty big plane for Newt to be flying around on if it could hold 80 Republicans.
Did you do any nexus searches to see how many newspapers reported on who was transporting Newt from point A to point B?
I have not seen a single story on this latest incident where he was attending the fundraisers. Now, it is true that in the past, Newt has been caught a couple of times. Not, I don't believe by the mainstream press, though. Common Cause had a story about the Bohemian Grove, which is where I heard about that. What we reported on was this the fundraising trips earlier this year.
Now, you report that when it comes to taking money and favors from corporate America, the Democrats are certainly no better than the Republicans. And why don't you tell us a little about Breaux?
Well, Senator Breaux is one of the leading Democratic senators in Congress, and he heads what's called the Majority Trust, which they call the premier donor program of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. And I got a letter that Breaux sent out to wealthy individuals telling them that if they gave more than $20,000 or more to the Democratic Party, they'd become members of the Majority Trust. And then they could accompany Democratic senators to wonderful events where they would mix the discussion of important issues with things like skiing in Aspen. In January, the lucky contributors went on a ski trip to Aspen, where they were joined by Hal Heflin of Alabama, Joe Biden of Delaware, and Tom Harkin of Iowa. And the memo also, or the letter also, included reference to some events last year. My favorite was the Nantucket weekend, where the $20,000 and up donors were put up at the White Elephant Inn. They met with a number of senators, and they mixed relaxing summer activities, private receptions, and dinners. So it was quite a fun weekend, I'm sure.
Now, since we've been following the presidential candidates rather closely, and we only have a few minutes here, I didn't want to leave Senator Bob Dole out of this discussion of U.S. tobacco.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have actually tried to get to that as well. Dole, like Newt, is a very, very warm friend of U.S. Tobacco. He's a frequent flyer on their company jets. But the relationship is even more intricate than that. UST, Dole has a PAC, a political action committee called Better America, and UST has made vast dispensations to his PAC. And a UST senior vice president sits on the board of the Dole Foundation. That is a foundation for the disabled. And Dole, curiously, has been...
To disable or for the disabled?
I'm sorry, for the disabled.
To disabled people or for disabled?
For disabled.
When you talk about U.S. Tobacco and the disabled.
You never know. No, but this in this case, the Dole Foundation is for the disabled. Now, Dole has been UST's probably its closest friend in Congress. UST has a very good record. They've listed on their lobbying disclosure forms, they've listed 24 issues between 1988 and 1993 that they wanted to defeat. They defeated every single one of them, and Dole played a leading role on many, many occasions.
Well, Ken, we are going to have you back to talk further about these issues. We want to get into the whole issue of one Tommy Boggs, a brother of ABC TV's Cokie Roberts, and one of the most powerful corporate lobbyists in Washington, but we're going to have to do that next time. Ken Silverstein of Counterpunch, telling the facts, naming the names. You can get this newsletter by calling
202-986-3665.
That's 202-986-3665. Ken Silverstein, thanks for joining us. Coming up next, the war on drugs. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now!, of course, is Pacifica Radio's national grassroots daily election show heard around the country. And today we're looking at the issue of race and drugs. When you talk about drugs in this country, you have to talk about race because of the racially charged policies, public policies, legislation that have been passed around drugs, drug use, and drug abuse. Joining us to discuss this issue are three people. My co-host Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times, joins us from Chicago. And joining us here at the studios of WPFW in Washington are two guests who are certainly authorities on this subject. Nikichi Taifa is a professor at Howard University Law School. She's the director of the public service program there and teaches a seminar called Racial Disparity in the Criminal Justice System. She's formerly with the American Civil Liberties Union. We're also joined by Clarence Lussain, who is a political science professor at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, New York, and he's a graduate research assistant at the Center for Drug Abuse Research here in Washington at Howard University. He's also author of five books, including Pipe Dream Blues, Racism and the War on Drugs. Let's get right to this discussion, and I just want to let our listeners know that yesterday here in Washington, both Clarence and Nikichi were part of the Drug Abuse Research Seminar at Howard called Issues in U.S. Drug Abuse Policy, Justice for All or Just Us. Welcome, everyone, to Democracy Now!
Good day.
Glad to be here.
When President Bill Clinton nominated a four-star general as the nation's new drug czar, he deflected growing criticism that he had surrendered in the drug war, but by naming Barry R. McCaffrey to head the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which is euphemistically called the drug czar, he signals a further militarization of a war that really has taken its greatest toll on young African Americans. According to a report by the Sentencing Project, which is a Washington-based organization which conducts criminal justice research, The policies, quote, this is how they sum up the drug war. The policies and practices contained within the phrase war on drugs has been an unmitigated disaster for young blacks and other minorities. Well, to help us get a better understanding of the ramifications of this war on drugs and what change, if any, will the appointment of General McCaffrey make in this ill-fated war, we have Clarence Lussain and Nkechi Taifa. Clarence, you have written a book that deals extensively with the racial aspects of this war on drugs. How do you view the appointment of McCaffrey to this position?
It's a very important time, I think, in looking at the way in which public policy looks at this issue of drugs. There are a lot of people who believe that the appointment of the good general is election year politics being played out. When Clinton came into office, he did two what seemed to be contradictory things. One was to elevate the drug czar's office to a cabinet post. At the same time, though, he cut the staff of that office from 146 staffers down to 25 and cut the budget by $231 million. In other words, it was symbolically raised to a higher profile while substantively the program was cut, which people basically read as a retreat, and that the addressing the issue of substance abuse and trafficking was not going to be a major priority of the Clinton administration, and in fact it wasn't. Lee Brown spent about 2.5 years there, principally giving speeches around the country, and with his hands fairly tied, he wasn't really able to kind of do much. Now, I'm hesitant to use the term war on drugs because, as you indicated, that's been the philosophy of we're at a war against this inanimate thing, when in fact what's really been happening has been a war against people, and disproportionately people of color. And what we tried to do at the seminar yesterday was to look at, in this period, what's going on in this so-called war on drugs. The report you mentioned by the Sentencing Project, Malcolm Young, who's the executive director, spoke at our forum yesterday, and he talked about how the study they did 4 or 5 years ago, they talked about a quarter of young African-American males either being in prison, on parole, or on probation, that has risen to about a third, and almost all driven by the so-called war on drugs. And Nkechi can talk about some of the work she's been doing that specifically looks at what are the laws in place that perpetuate this discriminatory policy.
Nkechi, why don't you do that?
Okay, well, basically, I just want to start off by saying that invariably, people of color are subjected to unwarranted disparate treatment at every stage of the criminal justice policy process, from where the police are going to be deployed in terms of what communities, to police brutality and misconduct, to stops based on racial profiles, to the lack of diversity in jury pools, to abuse of prosecutorial discretion in matters of charging and pretrial release, to the type and length of sentence imposed. And one of the most glaring examples of racism in the criminal justice system is reflected in sentencing, particularly the sentencing for cocaine offenses. One of the main things I talked about at the seminar yesterday was the disparity in sentencing between crack and powder cocaine.
That has received a lot of publicity of late. And it seems on the face of it so obvious a disparity that there would be no objection to rectifying it. Why is there a dragging of feet, so to speak, in Congress?
Well, specifically, that disparity is a 100 times difference. The sentences for crack are 100 times more severe than the sentences for the exact same amount of powder cocaine. Possession, simple possession of 5 grams of crack carries a mandatory minimum sentence of at least 5 years in prison. Possession of the same amount of powder cocaine gives you probation, no jail time at all. 96.5% of those sentenced federally for crack offenses are people of color. Now, Salim, this is despite the fact that overwhelmingly the vast majority of crack users are not black, they are white. These statistics come from the National Institute on Drug Abuse's National Household Survey. Yet the war on drugs has been fought mainly in the black communities, and that is what has resulted in nearly one in three young black men being under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system at any given time. The experts have studied this issue. The United States Sentencing Commission was appointed by Congress to specifically study this issue of cocaine sentencing. Unanimously, they stated that the sentences for crack were too great and must be changed. Unanimously, they stated that the sentences for simple possession of crack must be the same as simple possession of any other drug. It must be equal. And the majority of the commission said that the sentences for crack distribution must be equal as well. What did Congress and the president do? They thumbed their nose at the report from the very experts they appointed to study this issue, bowed to political pressure. And the status quo remains.
Was that President Clinton?
That's correct.
The political pressure, you say. What is that political pressure based on? Why is there this insistence that crack be treated differently than other forms of cocaine?
Yeah, I think that there were a couple things that happened in the 1980s. Just in general, kind of the political shift to the right. Particularly in the Democratic Party, so that it wasn't just the Republicans who began to take a conservative, extreme conservative approach to public policy, but they were joined by the Democrats. And in the midst of the crack explosion that happened in the mid-80s, it wasn't just that crack was demonized, but crack users were demonized. And that became a very, that has become a very difficult kind of perspective to break, even with the scientific evidence coming in from all quarters, from the medical community, from the legal community. That perspective has found root now. And in an election year, in 1996, where the possibility of Clinton losing to a Robert Dole because of the perceptions of where the country is at on conservative politics and the whole new way in which public policy is constructed in the era of the contract with America, it becomes the safe route to take the hard line that we must crack down on crime, we must crack down on drug users, and that's going to be the approach we're going to get in 1996, even with all the evidence contradicting that at every single level. And that means, as it has historically, that people of color, particularly African Americans and Latinos, are going to catch the brunt of these laws that have been passed. There is another study that was just done on the three strikes law in California that is intimately tied in with drugs, because it mainly says if you commit three violent crimes, you can be sentenced to life without possibility of parole. But under that, violent crimes also include a lot of drug crimes that don't involve violence but involve possession, involves of a certain amount, involves selling. And already that law has been in place about a year or so, and already they're showing that there's a 13-to-1 ratio of African Americans being convicted under that law as opposed to whites. And you've got some places in the state where no whites have been prosecuted under the law at all. So again, it just kind of rolls on and on and on in this period.
Let me just say something about that selective prosecution as well, if that's okay, because not only in the three strikes, but in other areas as well. The Supreme Court is about to decide a case dealing with an issue of selective prosecution. In L.A. County, federal prosecutors selectively pursued and charged blacks in crack cocaine cases. Since the crack law's inception, not a single white offender has been convicted of a crack offense in federal courts. And
Not one.
But the white crack offenders are steered to state court, where they're not subject to that state's inordinately law mandatory minimum sentences. And in fact, in the case before the Supreme Court, the decision of the prosecutors to prosecute the defendant federally is significant. 3 years, which is what they would have gotten in state court, versus life without parole. So the blacks face life without parole. The whites, basically a slap on the wrist. And that is not limited to Los Angeles. It's happening all over the country.
You're listening to Nikechi Taifa, who is an attorney and director of the Public Service Program at Howard University School of Law. And we're also joined by Clarence Lussain, who is a political science professor at Medgar Evers College and author of, among other books, Pipe Dream Blues, Racism and the War on Drugs. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington with Salim Wakil in Chicago. I've been wondering if you've been following the presidential campaign at all, and if the candidates have been referring to drugs in a way that's different. Have you been surprised by the lack of reference to it and the lack of reference to urban problems at all?
Well, I think that what's going to occur as we kind of move into the general campaign will be a lot of focus on crime. And that will, again, take a racial edge. And what I think the president is doing is trying to protect himself by signing these crime bills, by doing this appointment of the general to the drug czar, all of which is to say that when that comes up in the debate, no, I have been tough on crime. No, I have tried to address this issue. We will not coddle criminals. We will three strikes out and send people away for life if that's what we need to do. We will allocate money to build more prisons. So Clinton, I believe, is protecting himself around those kinds of issues. Meanwhile, on the other side, of course, you've got the Republicans who are trying to figure out how do you go past a Democratic president who basically has stolen all of our issues around crime. And so you kind of get almost hysterical kinds of policies and proposals coming out of people on the Hill that are not only undemocratic, but absolutely unconstitutional. You've got people who say, let's abandon parole. You've got people who say, let's build prisons in Mexico, because now with NAFTA, we can build them down there cheaper, and on and on and on. You've got people who are saying, forget Miranda rights. All of these kind of proposals are coming up as
erosion
a way
of the exclusionary rule, cutting back on habeas corpus.
All trying to outdo Clinton on crime policy. So I think that's where in 96 we will see some of the most wildest and ridiculous and dangerous kinds of proposals. And then what in fact happens is some of those actually slip through. Some of those actually do become law.
Do you see anyone arguing a more sensible course of affairs in this drug war? I mean, is there anyone who is trying to argue against the draconian trend that Clarence talked about?
Well, I think that's where our grassroots organizations need to come in to play. Many of the organizations that I'm involved in, such as the National Conference of Black Lawyers, among others, have been working very assiduously to try to bring these atrocities to public attention and try to change them. On the more political, shall we say, level, the Congressional Black Caucus has in fact attempted to wield its voice. Many times it's a voice in the wilderness, and it's really not being heard. They were ignored on the crack cocaine issue. They were essentially ignored on the crime bill debate. So it's incumbent upon the grassroots to show our clout at the ballot box.
Yeah, essentially, the Congressional Black Caucus has become a minority of the minority on Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. so they absolutely mm-hmm. have no platform. What I think has to happen is when we do get opportunities for platforms, that's when there has to be a strong united front in the African-American community around these particular issues. An example I would give would be the Million Man March. Reverend Jesse Jackson at that march focused a great deal of his remarks on the disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing that mm-hmm. Nkechi talked about. But we needed consistent voices at that platform to make that an issue so that it wouldn't be mm-hmm. lost. You know, you had 80 speakers. One or two references to that are going to be lost. But to the degree the black community forges an agenda, and this is whether it's coming from Reverend Jesse Jackson, whether it's coming from Mfume now at the NAACP, whether it's coming from Donald Payne and the Congressional Black Caucus, all these people who have opportunities for national platforms have to take advantage and be on the same page. We need that kind of focus in order to make some breakthroughs.
And what needs to happen also, we really need to look at the long-range implications of what I call the criminalization of a race. We need to look at exactly what all of this increased incarceration will end up resulting in. More blacks having stigmatizing felony records, ensuring negative consequences for future employment. It will mean virtual disenfranchisement for large segments of the African-American community where conviction of a felony results in the loss of the right to vote. You have disruption and disintegration of families, termination of parental rights, all of these result in incalculable damages to black people. And I consider it the institutionalization of genocide upon black people.
You're listening to Nkechi Taifa, who's an attorney and director of the Public Service Program at the Howard University School of Law, where they're conducting a series of seminars on issues in U.S. drug policy. We're also joined by Clarence Lussane, a professor at Megar Evers College in New York, and author of Pipe Dream Blues, Racism and the War on Drugs, and of course, Salim Wakil in Chicago. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Again, joining me in the studio, Nkechi Taifa, Howard University Law School professor, Clarence Lussane, author of Pipe Dream Blues, Racism and the War on Drugs, and he's also writing a new book right now. And we're joined in Chicago by Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times.
Clarence and Nkechi, it seems kind of ironic that the conservatives appear to be leading the way in devising new approaches on this attack on drug use, with the suggestion that we legalize drugs. The National Review just did an entire issue on that particular subject. Do you think there's any hope in that direction?
No, I don't. I think that there's definitely a strain within the conservative movement, some who see themselves as libertarian, actually, from Milton Friedman to others, who believe that not that drugs are necessarily good, but that there are issues of freedom, of individual mm-hmm. freedom that are at stake. But they are a very distinct, very small minority in the conservative movement overall. Particularly...
But do you think that prescriptions are appropriate, the legalization and or at least decriminalization of drug use?
Certainly there needs to be that dialogue. And that has been something like Kurt Smoke and others have been advocating for a number of mm-hmm. years. And I'm one of the people who support that dialogue happening. I think that there are pros and cons to legalization, and it's not I don't support a blanket legalization, but I certainly support decriminalization of particular drugs. And I think that that's a dialogue that would be useful and fruitful to the nation and particularly to the African-American community. But getting to more radical and alternative solutions is prevented at this point because of the strength of the conservative movement around this issue and the absolute disappearance of any liberal or progressive voices at the table as these things start to get debated around public policy. So that's where I think that until we're at the table, we will not get past what are some of the draconian and ultra-conservative kinds of responses.
I have to say, I didn't see any mention in the corporate media as we just come out of the primary in Texas of the fact that the Texas prison system is one of the largest in the world. And as we move into the California primary, that the prison guard lobby in California is the second strongest lobby in the state.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things that people have been referring to lately is the jail industrial complex.
Yes.
And what we see with that is this whole move towards privatization of jails as they grow and grow and grow. And states basically cannot afford to build prisons anymore. Even the most conservative Republican governors have started to back off because they recognize that they're just busting the budget. In California, for example, it was estimated 2 years ago before the three strikes and out law was passed, that they would have to build 12 prisons between 1995 and the year 2000. With the 12 with the three strikes law, that estimate was shot up to 36 prisons. Now, that's just an amazing, unbelievable amount of diversion of funds from virtually everywhere to build prisons that basically produce nothing for society at all. So I think that you've got that kind of process going on that is shaking up the whole system.
I'm still thinking about your comment, Clarence. Private prisons in Mexico for U.S. prisoners?
Absolutely. This was from one of the new Republicans on Capitol Hill, I believe from South Carolina, who said that, you know, with NAFTA, that means that we now can put prisons in Mexico that can be run cheaply. We don't have to deal with this lobby of parole officers and prison workers. And that when the issue was raised, well, you know, don't they like speak Spanish? And wouldn't that be a hardship on the families? And the response was, well, prisoners don't need to know Spanish. You know, they're in jail. I mean, but that's the attitude, you know, from take away the barbells, take away color televisions. You know, it's a very dehumanized, very brutal kind of philosophy that's driving all of this.
And put in the chain gangs.
And the chain gangs are back.
Well, let's not forget the chain gangs. How big is this movement?
Oh, it's definitely increasing, and I consider this another example of the militarization of just what is going on here. Clarence was talking about the prison industrial complex, which basically replaced the military industrial complex of earlier years, and the prison industry is becoming a multi-million dollar industry, and to continue to feed and fuel it, these repressive, harsh, draconian laws are continually being passed.
I was in rural Illinois a few weeks ago, and they just announced that a prison was going up in their proximity, and there was a big parade in town celebrating.
Big money.
Clarence, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, and when you look at who's investing in these prisons, you've got American Express, you've got General Electric, you got Merrill Lynch, Prudential, Smith Barney. You have some of the largest multinational corporations in the world who are investing in prisons, who coincidentally are also some of the largest donors to the Republican and Democratic Party, and to congressional candidates and to presidential candidates. So it all kind of comes together as part of a mosaic of corporate conservative ties that the consequence are that people suffer who are not part of that game, who aren't in those meetings, aren't at that table. And I think that, you know, in terms of where do we kind of go, and what we talked about at the forum yesterday, one of the things that people have been calling for has been for an urban summit. From the day that Clinton got elected, and he had the economic summit between the time he got elected and the time he took the oath, people have been calling for an urban summit because 12 years of Reagan and Bush basically meant that the cities were absolutely abandoned and left to their own limited and shrinking resources. Clinton never done that, did not do that, and it's unlikely that he's going to do it this year. So I think then it becomes incumbent upon progressives, upon black leaders, whether it's the NAACP, whether it's the National African American Leadership Summit, whether it's the Congressional Black Caucus, to pull that together, because there are people around the country in every community who are trying to address this issue and have come up with some very innovative and working solutions, but have not had the ability to network and the ability to make this a national issue.
Kwayusi Mfume of NAACP, is there any signs that he would be calling for something like this?
At this moment, that has not been something that he's talked about, but I think it's incumbent on people to push him in that direction. NAACP would be an excellent venue to bring together people around the country who are doing this work.
One of the things that I think needs to be looked at in some sort of urban summit is U.S. drug policy and just who they're targeting. Their professed priority is the targeting of major drug trafficking organization, major drug kingpins and the like, but the reality is that the enforcement has been primarily waged against low-level street dealers. Right. And the Sentencing Commission's report said that 60% of those arrested for crack offenses are the low level at the very bottom of the drug distribution network, yet they are receiving sentences that are longer than their wholesale suppliers who supply the powder cocaine from which the crack is produced. There really needs to be a change and a shift in U.S. drug policy, and it needs to be changed from a militaristic approach to one that deals with addressing some of the root causes and root causes of crime.
How can people get in touch with you? If they're interested in this issue, they want to get some kind of mobilization going, push leaders at the top to start dealing with this, demanding that they deal with this, how do they reach you?
Well, they can reach the Center for Drug Abuse Research, and we can link them up with resources and information. They can reach us at area code 202-806-9219. That's 202-806-9219.
And that's the Drug Abuse Research Seminar at Howard University.
And they can reach the National Conference of Black Lawyers, which has been very active on these criminal justice issues, at 202-234-9735. 202-234-9735.
We want to thank you very much for joining us. We're going to continue this discussion both domestically and also in terms of foreign policy. Where is the money going abroad when the president talks about the war on drugs? Is it going actually to fight drugs, or is it going to repressive, sometimes military and often civilian backed by military regimes that in fact are doing the drug dealing themselves? That's another
good
issue
point,
we'll
Amy.
Discuss on Democracy Now. Well, Salim Wakil, thanks for joining us from Chicago, senior editor at In These Times and co-host of Democracy Now! And we also want to thank Clarence Lussane, political science professor at Medgar Evers College. His book, Get It, Read It, Pipe Dream Blues, Racism and the War on Drugs. And Nkechi Taifa, attorney and director of the Public Service Program at the Howard University School of Law. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Well, don't you know that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang? Well, don't you know that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang?
Oh, boy. Oh, dear Lord, he worked so hard until the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and sometimes wearing a low frown. You hear the moan, the lies away. Then you'll hear somebody say,
well, don't you know that's the sound of the men working on the chain.
And on a much lighter note, while the Persuasions were singing, we were able to catch up with Clinton on the campaign trail. Well, feminist comedian Kate Clinton, that is. Kate, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Delray Beach, Florida. We're just kind of cleaning up after Super Tuesday. We had the big Super Tuesday, the big primary here in Florida. I can look out and see one of the Bush's houses right now across the water.
How is your campaign going?
Well, you know, we didn't get a single delegate. Actually, Alan Keyes got one, just one more than I do now. But we're encouraged. I'm really encouraged.
Why?
Well, it seems to be what you do. If you lose, you act like you won, and if you won, you act like you lost. So even though I did not get a single delegate, I'm very, very happy. I'm excited, encouraged. Bob Dole swept Super Tuesday. You would think, I mean, the way he looks, he looks very sad, kind of hangdog. You'd think that he'd actually lost the election, as opposed to Buchanan and Forbes, who are positively exuberant, even though they didn't do well at all.
Do you think Forbes is going to drop out?
I don't know. I've heard that he needs more money, and I guess he sold the entire state of New Jersey, so he has more money and he can stay in now.
Will Buchanan drop out?
Buchanan, I don't think he's too mean to quit. And actually, we tried to get something on the ballot measure here in Florida that it would be impossible for a talk show pundit, whatever that means, to get back their old spot on the show if they, you know, if they lose these primaries, which I would be very happy not to see him on that show. What is it? It's Meet the Oppressor or something. So I don't think he should be able to. I think maybe Trent Lott should take his old job. And So we tried to get that. I tried to get term limits, but here in Florida, everybody thought, they're so concerned about wildlife, they thought I said turn limits. And I thought maybe something, I said term limits on Larry King, who I'm tired of. It looks like he's got an extra row of bottom teeth. Looks like that kind of the Farfel dog, you know, that N-E-S-D-L-E. So I think we could get rid of him.
Where are you going next, Kate?
Well, I'm dawdling a little bit here in Florida, I must tell you. It's so nice. You know, we have pastels and blues, and it's not so beige and monochromatic. So I'm dawdling a little bit before I go to the Midwest, where it's, I guess, sort of monochromatic and fairly overcast at this point. But I'll be going to the Michigan, Illinois, you know, the upper Midwest.
Is weather important to you?
It's quite important to me. It's not only getting the voters out, but Alexander Haig, I think, really showed the importance of a good tan. And I never forgot that. And he was in charge so quickly there. But so tanning is important. It's a bit shallow, but it's really quite a shallow primary.
Yeah, let me ask you something. Are you doing any of the standard, using any of the standard gimmicks of the other candidates? I mean, any, for example, are you using focus groups?
Well, as a matter of fact, we just did hire a guy who claims he does focus groups. I'm not real sure about him. His name is Rory Shark. And so we ran a couple of focus groups here in Florida and a couple of in Michigan, Bemidji. And he said the two words that we should concentrate are on our brisket and jejun. And I don't know where we're going from there. But
have you come up with some slogans?
He had the brisket, which it might not be too catchy. It was very big here in Miami.
What about where's the brisket?
Where's the brisket? That's very good. Thank you. And we've actually purchased a few words left over from the Lamar Alexander campaign. Contest of vision, which is just very edgy and hard-hitting. Makes me think of Renaissance fairs.
Are you...
When I run around going, it's the 60s. They're over.
Are you hoping to retire his debt? Is that why you paid for some of these?
Yes, I'm trying to help him out. And actually, giant bolts of black and red flannel now are available.
Actually, you might be able to help him out by buying some of those shirts.
Yes.
Well, do you think it's a little unfair, I mean, playing on the Clinton name, I mean, that you might be siphoning off some of the votes when people see Clinton for president, that you might be siphoning them off from the real president?
Pardon me? I'm shocked by this information. No, I think that name recognition is important. And, you know, I think any little help that he can get at this point, you know, they backed up on a lot of things. The Clinton administration, they backed up in health care, Lanny Guinier, gays in the military. Sometimes I think there's a campaign theme song ought to be bat, 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 indicating a backing up sound. I have a cold, I'm sorry. Changing planes as we do.
Oh, so you're suggesting that he's actually gaining votes because people think he's you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. When I bring Leslie Gore on with my, you know, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to. I think we're going to bounce the numbers.
Well, we look forward to talking to you at your next campaign stop if you'll take our call.
I certainly will. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Vote for me.
Thank you very much. And next time, don't call collect, okay?
Oh, right. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And as we follow Kate Clinton on the campaign trail, it brings to mind this question. What makes a person qualified to be president of the United States? Democracy Now! Wants to know what you think. How much and what kind of prior government experience is necessary? Should our president have a college degree, be a parent, know what it's like to work for minimum wage? Should the president have served in the military or be an anti-war protester? What should he or she have accomplished in their lives before seeking the nation's highest office? Maybe you think we shouldn't have a president at all. This week, Democracy Now! Is asking you to think about these questions and write us a job description for the presidency. Get a pen and we'll tell you where to send your ideas. You can write it like a formal job description, a classified ad, or you can submit an imaginary resume of a candidate you could support. please send your presidential job descriptions with your daytime telephone number to Democracy Now, 702 H Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2001. That's Democracy Now, 702 H Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2001. Or you can fax it to us at 202-737-3723. That's 202-737-3723. Or email it at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Ken Mason. Help from Errol Maitland in New York. You can order a cassette of the show at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Join me for another edition of Democracy Now! Tomorrow.